From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now! Jury deliberations are underway in New York in the landmark trial of Ahmed Khalfan Ghailani, the first former Guantanamo prisoner to be tried in a civilian court. We'll get the latest. Then a white former Alabama state trooper pleads guilty to killing a black civil rights worker 45 years ago. His death sparked the Selma to Montgomery march when police attacked demonstrators crossing a bridge that became known as Bloody Sunday. We'll be joined by Congressmember John Lewis, who helped lead the march, and with the reporter to whom the Alabama state trooper first confessed the killing. Then, part two of our conversation with Wendell Carter. He was the chief spokesman for health insurance giant Cigna, now Whistleblower. He talks about the industry's campaign to discredit Michael Moore and his film Sicko.
At one point during a strategy meeting, one of the people from APCO said that if our efforts, our initial efforts, were not successful, then we'd have to move to an element of the campaign to push Michael Moore off a cliff.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The nation's biggest lenders are reportedly preparing to create a compensation fund for borrowers who lost their homes in improper foreclosures. According to The Washington Post, banks are negotiating details with officials heading the foreclosure investigation by all 50 state attorneys general. The probe was launched last month following revelations mortgage companies made misleading or fraudulent statements and signed off on documents without proper review to approve foreclosures. The attorneys general are focusing on the three largest mortgage servicers, Bank of America, J.P. Morgan Chase and Wells Fargo, with other banks to follow. The news comes as executives from some of the nation's top banks appeared before a Senate Banking Committee hearing on foreclosure crisis. Committee Chair Christopher Dodd of Connecticut said widespread banking practices are threatening homeowners.
Many believe that the robo-signing errors are simply the tip of a much larger iceberg, that they are emblematic of a much deeper problems at the mortgage servicing business, problems that have resulted in homeowners, of course, losing their homes in unjustifiable foreclosures. In fact, servicing practices may be putting homeowners at risk.
During the hearing, Chase Home Lending Chief Executive David Lohman was interrupted by protesters as he delivered prepared remarks. One protester unveiled a banner reading, "David Lohman Lies." A top NATO official says foreign troops could remain in Afghanistan far beyond a newly touted withdrawal deadline. The Obama administration said it will extend a conditional date for withdrawing troops by 3 years to 2014. But speaking to reporters ahead of a NATO summit in Portugal, the top NATO civilian official in Afghanistan, Mark Sedwill, said, quote, "The end of 2014 does not mean the mission's over, but the mission changes. It's the inflection point, if you like." Sedwill's comments come as the Canadian government has announced plans to end its combat mission in Afghanistan. In a blow to the U.S.-led NATO occupation, the Canadian Foreign Minister, Lawrence Cannon, said Canadian forces will leave Kandahar next year.
"And despite the urgings of our NATO allies, we shall withdraw from Kandahar and shut down our combat mission. But we are not abandoning the Afghan people. After 2011, our efforts will be centered in Kabul. We shall dedicate ourselves to development, diplomacy, and a non-combat role in training members of the Afghan National Security Forces."
Protests are continuing in Haiti over the cholera outbreak that's now killed over 1,000 people. On Tuesday, residents clashed with U.N. troops in the city of Cap-Haïtien for the second consecutive day. Nepalese troops stationed there have been accused of inadvertently bringing the cholera outbreak to Haiti. Haitian President René Préval has issued a nationwide appeal for calm a week before elections to choose his successor. At a camp for earthquake survivors in Port-au-Prince, community activist Fennel Domersant said Haitian and U.N. officials have failed to properly warn residents.
"We do not receive any aid here in this camp. You would think there was never a problem here because no one ever came here to campaign against cholera and make the people aware of the situation."
The UN Security Council has rejected a plea to investigate the Moroccan government's recent crackdown on the pro-independence movement in Western Sahara. Moroccan security forces last week raided a camp where some 20,000 Sahrawis staged a massive protest against the Moroccan occupation. Dozens of protesters were wounded. Representatives of Western Sahara's Polisario Front had asked the United Nations to send a fact-finding mission to investigate. But on Tuesday, the Security Council denied the request, instead releasing a statement deploring the recent violence without saying who is to blame. The new UN expert on torture is calling on the United States to investigate and prosecute torture committed under former President George W. Bush. In his first interview since taking over as the new UN Special Rapporteur on torture, Juan Ernesto Mendez said, quote, "The United States has a duty to investigate every act of torture. Unfortunately, we haven't seen much in the way of accountability," he said. Mendez also said he hopes to visit Iraq and Guantanamo to probe widespread torture allegations. Mendez was himself a victim of torture under the Argentine dictatorship in the 1970s. The Obama administration has been dealt a major setback in efforts to obtain Senate ratification of an arms reduction treaty with Russia. The new Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty, or New START, calls for the United States and Russia to cut their deployed arsenals to 1,550 nuclear warheads and 700 missile silos and bombers each. On Tuesday, Republican Senator John Kyle of Arizona said the pact shouldn't be voted on until next year. Kyle had previously broken with other Republicans to back the treaty. His new stance means Democrats will have to obtain 14 Senate Republican votes in the next Congress instead of the 8 they would currently need with a greater Senate majority. A congressional panel has convicted Democratic Congressmember Charles Rangel of New York on 11 counts of ethics violations. Rangel was cited for acts including failing to report rental income, improperly leasing a rent-stabilized apartment, and receiving donations from people with business before Congress. The House prosecutor, R. Blake Chisholm, said there is no evidence Rangel engaged in corruption, but maintained his practices violated congressional ethics rules. Rangel had asked for a delay in the trial because he says he couldn't afford to pay his attorneys. The full House Ethics Committee will now deliberate on whether to punish Rangel, beginning on Thursday. A team of scientific experts has faulted BP, its contractors and government officials, for missteps that led to the Gulf of Mexico oil spill. In a preliminary report, a 15-member committee from the National Academy of Engineering says BP's, quote, "insufficient consideration of risk and lack of operating discipline contributed to the largest offshore oil spill in U.S. history." The report also criticizes the Minerals Management Service, the government agency responsible for overseeing offshore drilling, for, quote, "insufficient checks and balances for decisions on well safety." Overall, the report says regulation of oil drilling has been, quote, "relatively minimal compared to other high-risk industries." Dozens of people gathered here in New York Tuesday night to protest a fundraiser for a group that finances Israeli settlements in the occupied West Bank city of Hebron. The Hebron Fund is one of over two dozen tax-exempt U.S. charities that have raised millions of dollars for West Bank settlements. Gloria Bletter of the Adala Campaign for the Boycott of Israel criticized the Obama administration's record on Palestinian human rights.
We're against exacerbating the facts of the occupation. It's been so terrible up till now, what Israel has been doing, and militarily, and killing, and starving Gazans and people in the West Bank, that every time it seems to get worse. It seems like they up the ante again and again. And this government, Obama, is going along with them. It doesn't stand up to them.
The American Civil Liberties Union and the Southern Poverty Law Center have filed a federal class action suit against the operators of a for-profit youth prison in Mississippi. The suit alleges children held at the Walnut Grove Youth Correctional Facility have been subjected to barbaric and unconstitutional conditions and excessive uses of force. The prison is run by the GEO Group, the nation's second largest private prison firm. And Pittsburgh has become the first Pennsylvania city to pass a measure barring natural gas drilling. In a unanimous vote, the Pittsburgh City Council approved the ban within city limits. Pittsburgh sits atop the Marcellus Shale, which has large reserves of natural gas. Opponents say natural gas drilling has contaminated water and air in communities across the nation. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. A federal jury in New York is deliberating in a landmark trial of the first former Guantanamo detainee to be tried in civilian court. On Monday, the jury appeared deadlocked after a juror asked to be excused, saying she was being attacked for her conclusions about the defendant, Ahmed Khalfan Ghailani. A Tanzanian national, Ghailani faces conspiracy and murder charges related to the 1998 U.S. Embassy bombings in Kenya and Tanzania that killed 224 people and wounded thousands. It's unclear whether the dissenting juror was alone in wanting to acquit or to convict Ghailani. Prosecutors described him as a mass murderer with, quote, the blood of hundreds on his hands. But the defense claims Ghailani was just a pawn who was unwittingly exploited by members of al-Qaeda. If convicted, Ghailani faces a mandatory life prison sentence. He was captured in Pakistan in 2004, taken to a secret overseas CIA jail, then moved to Guantanamo in 2006. At the start of the trial, the presiding federal judge barred the government from calling in their star witness, ruling that information about the witness had been revealed by Ghailani while he was being tortured in a secret CIA prison. For more on this case and the significance of holding this trial in federal court here in New York, I'm joined by Karen Greenberg. She runs the Center on Law and Security at the New York University Law School and is author of The Least Worst Place, Guantanamo's First 100 Days. She's been closely following the Ghailani trial since it began last month and has written about it for Mother Jones magazine. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
First, tell us—give us more background on this trial and what has been presented to the jury so far?
First thing you have to understand, I think, about this trial is that it was the test trial, the test case, to see whether we could bring other Guantanamo detainees, high-value detainees like Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, to the federal courts and perhaps to the Southern District of New York. So it's been—it's very closely watched, I think, by people in Washington. Who have to make this decision. So that's the context in which it's taking place. It was considered a good case because this court, Southern District, has tried embassy bombings suspects before and convicted them in 2001. So it seemed like a case that would be easy, it would get to conviction. But now, you know, the jury's doing what it does. It deliberates. And I think with this particular juror, we can't guess too much what it's about because they have 286 counts to decide. The first five are conspiracy charges. They have to get through those counts first. And you have to expect some sort of debate if they're going to deliberate seriously. And they are deliberating seriously, which tells you a lot about the progress we may have made in terrorism trials.
Do they know he's from Guantanamo? Do they know that he was tortured?
Probably not. I mean, it's their—they are supposed to not read anything about the case. They are vetted ahead of time about, you know, how they feel and what they know. This was all in pretrial. All of the torture discussion, his being tortured in a black site, and whether or not he could stand trial because of it, and what the evidentiary standards would be because of it, was all vetted prior to the trial starting. They may not know that. They may not know he's from Guantanamo. They may have a sense of it. It's not part of what's come up in court.
What number juror is having problems right now?
She's seat number 12.
And who is she? What do you know about her?
We don't know
that
much.
What has she said?
There's been a little bit of reporting. We know that the report came back saying, "I feel she felt that she was attacked," but you never know why.
When you say that, she what wrote a note to the judge?
She wrote a note to the judge early on in the deliberations, which is now, you know, a couple days ago, saying that she wanted to be excused, that she wasn't going to change her mind, and that we don't know what her mind was, but that she wasn't going to change her mind, and that she'd like to be excused or replaced, and I think the judge thought, well, you know, this is a little early in the process for this, and to take somebody off who has a separate opinion is not really what you want to do in a jury. You want 12 people to talk among themselves and figure it out. That's That's the point of it. And so we don't know. They could be, you know, in the midst of these deliberations. They've asked for a number of things over the course of their deliberations, substantial amounts of the transcript, stipulations from the government about what happened, about various searches that took place that were central to both defense and prosecutorial narratives. They have a lot of material to go through, and it seems like they're taking it seriously. And so she's an indication of that, and I think that's about as much as we can read into it.
Karen Greenberg, tell us more about who Gailani is, what you know about him, why the chief prosecution witness is not going to be allowed to testify.
The chief prosecution witness was not allowed to testify because there was no evidence presented or argued in any way that he was found other than through the torture of Khaled Ahmed Khalfan Gailani, who is the defendant. And the judge, having ruled that you could have this trial despite the fact that torture was alleged and for the purpose of this trial accepted as something that had happened, he made the distinction between being able to hold the trial and being able to introduce evidence that seemed to have come from torture and that there was no contradictory evidence otherwise. And so he didn't let it in, which was a groundbreaking decision, if you think about it. I mean, if we're going to have a moment of accountability for torture, which we haven't had, this was one. If you torture someone, that evidence does not get into court. So this was, you know, for those of us, the few of us paying attention, it was a milestone.
Now tell us more about Gailani.
Gailani was a young man in his early 20s in 1998 when the crime took place. He lived in Dar es Salaam, and he was involved in a number of the transactions that eventually led—this is what is alleged—to the to the attack on the embassies. It's being portrayed as a double attack, both in Kenya and in Tanzania, because you know the bombings happened on the same day within moments of one another. And they're presenting it as they did the original embassy bombings case, was in the context of a larger connection to al-Qaeda. But that was never really argued, you know, his direct connection to al-Qaeda. What's at issue here in this case is, did he, you know, help purchase the truck? Did he purchase the things that were used as the explosive knowingly or unknowingly? Was he just a young boy who helped some older men who he respected, who were businessmen, to do these things, not knowing that what they were for, or did he not know? And we know very little about him. Remember that the burden is on the prosecution. Defense does not have to present a case. They virtually didn't. They didn't call a witness, and they didn't put him on the stand. So we know this much about him. And no more. We know that a ticket was bought in his name on the same day to leave the country that some of the others who have been convicted left on, or who we later found out to be terrorists and were later killed. The defense has argued that we don't know that he got on the plane, and there were other people on the plane who had forged documents. So this is the nature of the case. And he himself, if you'd like to know, has been mostly absent from the case. I mean, he sat in the courtroom, but if you counted the times his name actually came up in the trial, you would find that it was minuscule compared to the, you know, amount of other people and words and context. And so it was sort of interesting to watch a trial about somebody who was barely mentioned.
It's interesting also there was such a outcry over a Guantanamo prisoner being tried in a New York court, and now that it's actually happening, there's almost no attention at all.
There's no attention. There's the press that comes every day because that's what they're doing, and then there's the observer gallery, which is literally empty other than myself and one or two others each day. There were witness observers brought in for the trial from Kenya and Tanzania, as there were in the first trial. But not only has there been no attention, there's been no sense of danger, or it's actually a rather collegial atmosphere inside the courtroom.
I wanted to switch to a different issue, which is President Bush, George W. Bush. His memoir has come out. I want to play a clip from NBC Today Show's Matt Lauer, the exclusive he did with George W. Bush.
Let's talk about waterboarding.
Okay.
We believe America is going to be attacked again. There's all kinds of intelligence coming in. And one of the high-valued al-Qaeda operatives was Khalaik Sheikh Mohammed, the chief operating officer of al-Qaeda, ordered the attack on 9/11. And they say, he's got information. I said, find out what he knows.
He needs him.
And so I said to our team, are the techniques legal? And a legal team says, yes, they are. And I said, use them.
Why is waterboarding legal, in your opinion?
Because the lawyer said it was legal. It said it did not fall within the Anti-Torture Act. I'm not a lawyer. But you got to trust the judgment of people around you, and I do.
You say it's legal, and the lawyers told me.
Yeah.
Critics say that you got the Justice Department to give you the legal guidance and the legal memos that you wanted. Tom Kaine, who was the former Republican co-chair of the 9/11 Commission, said they got legal opinions they wanted from their own people.
He obviously doesn't know. I hope Mr. Kaine reads the book. That's why I've written the book. He can draw whatever conclusion they want. But I will tell you this, using those techniques saved lives. My job was to protect America, and I did. First of all, we used this technique on three people.
Mm-hmm.
Captured a lot of people and used it on three. We gained valuable information to protect the country, and it was the right thing to do as far as I'm concerned.
So if it's legal, President Bush, then if American is taken into custody in a foreign country, not necessarily a uniformed
Look,
American.
I'm not going to debate the issue, Matt.
I'm just asking, would it be okay for a foreign country to waterboard an American citizen?
All I ask is that people read the book, and they can reach the same conclusion if they'd have made the same decision I made or not.
You'd make the same decision again today?
Yeah, I would.
George W. Bush, former president of the United States. Karen Greenberg, your response?
My response is twofold. One, continual disappointment that we haven't learned much in understanding what actually keeps us safe in the world. And two, that this can be seen and is being seen by many as a way of excusing others. In other words, he gave the command, he did it, he was in charge. And so what does that mean about everybody else? So those are my two basic responses, I mean.
And saying he would do it again?
And saying he would do it again. I mean, tremendous disappointment. This did not prove to be a winning strategy.
And the UN Special Rapporteur on Torture, Juan Ernesto Mendez, saying the United States has a duty to investigate every act of torture. He said, unfortunately, we haven't seen much in the way of accountability.
We should investigate. We should investigate for sure.
And finally, President Obama saying in one of his first acts as president, he would close Guantanamo. And now Guantanamo, it looks like, will be open for the foreseeable future.
I think it will. And I think the reason is that he's made the political calculation that actually, when it comes right down to it, not enough people care.
Are people being tortured at Guantanamo today?
I don't think so. I don't think so. But we don't know, I guess. But I don't think so.
Karen Greenberg runs the Center on Law and Security at NYU Law School, author of The Least Worst Place, Guantanamo's First 100 Days. This is Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute.
Thank you, Amy.
Nocien Number 1 by the composer Erik Satie. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. A white former Alabama state trooper has pleaded guilty to killing a black civil rights worker 45 years ago at the height of the civil rights movement. 77-year-old James Bonard Fowler pled guilty to one count of second-degree manslaughter 2 weeks before he was set to go to trial. He had been charged with two counts of murder in the 1965 shooting of 26-year-old Jimmie Lee Jackson during a melee in a restaurant in Marion, Alabama. Fowler was sentenced to 6 months in prison and 6 months of unsupervised probation. Jackson's killing was a cornerstone in the civil rights movement. The Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. preached at his funeral. His death set off the first Selma to Montgomery march that became known as Bloody Sunday, when Alabama police attacked demonstrators crossing a bridge, an event many say helped lead to the Voting Rights Act of 1965. Monday's plea agreement brought an end to a case that's been 45 years in the making. In the 1960s, two grand juries investigated Jimmie Lee Jackson's killing, but chose not to pursue charges. Then in 2004, Fowler admitted to a reporter for the Anniston Star that he pulled the trigger that killed Jackson. He claimed he shot the unarmed Jackson in self-defense. It was the first time Jackson's shooter was publicly identified. The revelation helped lead prosecutors to bring charges against Fowler. John Fleming is the reporter to whom Jackson confessed. He's an editor-at-large at the Anniston Star and is a founder of the Civil Rights Cold Case Project. He's joining us now from Atlanta, Georgia, and will also be joined by Congressmember John Lewis, leading figure of the civil rights movement. He was at Jimmie Lee Jackson's funeral with Dr. Martin Luther King and helped lead the 1965 Selma to Montgomery march and was badly beaten by police. First, though, to John Fleming. John, talk about what happened in the that led to Jimmie Lee Jackson's death.
Well, it was a rare nighttime protest march in a place called Marion, Alabama, which is west of Selma, a place out kind of in the wilderness of Alabama's Black Belt. It was in late February of 1965. The protest got underway. It was a peaceful march around the town square, but Alabama state troopers and local law enforcement arrived and waded into the crowd and broke out billy clubs, and violence quickly broke out. During all this, a group of protesters slipped into a place called Mac's Cafe, a restaurant off the town square, and they were followed into that cafe by a group of state troopers. Mr. Fowler was one of these. And when they went inside, as you said, a melee broke out, and a number of people were hit, and objects were thrown around. And during this altercation, Mr. Jackson was shot by Trooper Fowler. Now, immediately after that, the trooper and some of his colleagues, they wrote affidavits and presented those. But those were never brought into the public domain. Those affidavits were kept in the Department of Public Safety in Alabama and never really saw the light of day. After all this happened, press reports and histories of the time just refer to a state trooper shooting Mr. Jackson. They never referred to Mr. Fowler by name.
And Fowler, in his affidavit, said he shot him, but it was never presented in court?
Well, his affidavit stated then that he shot in self-defense. And there were two grand juries which were convened soon after that. One was a federal grand jury, one was a state grand jury, but both of them immediately no-billed the case. Neither one were brought forward. But again, his affidavit said that he fired in self-defense.
In the scene, Taylor Branch writing, the cafe owner saw troopers attack Cager Lee again in the kitchen for trying to pull them off. Viola Jackson was beaten to the floor. Her son, Jimmie Lee Jackson, lunged to protect her. One trooper threw him against a cigarette machine. Another shot him twice in the stomach. And then they cudgeled him back outside toward the bus station where he collapsed.
That is true. That is how history has put it down. This is not what Trooper Fowler has always maintained, but history says it the other way. And of course, the mystery for everyone is that for so long was what the identity of the trooper was and what his side of the story was. I managed to find him in 2004, and we had this long conversation, this long interview, where in the middle of it he told me that he did indeed shoot Jimmie Lee Jackson, but again, it was in self-defense. So I just wrote the story in 2004, and soon after that, a number of things began to happen, which eventually led to his indictment in 2007 from a Perry County grand jury, which culminated in the plea agreement that we saw on Monday.
In a minute, we're going to be speaking with Congressmember John Lewis. But tell us who Jimmie Lee Jackson was, his significance, John Fleming.
Well, it was significant in his death was significant in that it brought about a determination within the local leadership of the civil rights movement on the ground around Selma at the time to do something. There was this feeling of infuriation by the leadership that law enforcement had involved in this. And the thought was is that the body of Jimmie Lee Jackson would be taken to Montgomery and put on the doorstep of the governor and to demand that something be done about that. Of course, that wasn't done. He was buried there in Marion. But this idea became to jail about the Selma to Montgomery march, about doing something momentous. So the movement started going in that direction, and the event that Congressman Lewis, of course, was very much involved in was the first Selma to Montgomery march in early March of 1965, which was met by Alabama state troopers on horseback and tear gas. And those are the images that were broadcast on national television, which really brought into focus the horrors that were going on in Alabama at the time. And that gave an opportunity to change some minds in the U.S. Senate. And eventually, we moved towards passage of the Voting Rights Act. And that's the historical significance.
And Jimmie Lee Jackson, now, personally.
The significance of this guilty plea that we saw on Monday, as Doug Jones, a former U.S. prosecutor, pointed out to me, that there is a guilty plea in the case. And it's something concrete that both the community around Marion and the people in that part of the Black Belt can have, and that the family of Jimmie Lee Jackson can have, which will allow us perhaps to move forward a bit.
And Jimmie Lee Jackson himself, at 26, he was the youngest deacon in his Baptist church. He was a veteran. He was a soldier.
Well, yes, these things are so. He was a fine man. I mean, you talk to anybody in Marion about him, and he was these things. But you get the sense also that he, as an individual, represented something of the future of the Black community around Marion. That, you know, one of the potential leaders and pillars of the community had been taken away from them. They as a community have been grieving for a really long time over this, the family and the community. And my conversations with his sister, especially, she feels like this has been a good thing, that this journey has, I won't say it's come to an end, but it certainly helped them move on.
John Fleming,
Amy,
I'd
like to point out quickly, too, that you know, in the Deep South, we have a lot of these kind of cases. The Jimmie Lee Jackson case was almost lost to history, and it is good that it was brought forward. But we have perhaps dozens of these kinds of cases in the Deep South. And my paper, The Anniston Star, has been very aggressive in trying to deal with some of this. But my collaborative as well, the Civil Rights Cold Case Project, is an effort at a new kind of investigative journalism, which we think can get to the bottom of more of these cases. And this plea that we had Monday, we also hope can provide a little bit of momentum towards looking at some of these other cases. The FBI has at least 60 that they are still holding open.
Well, John Fleming, we also have Congressmember John Lewis, also from the Atlanta area, but speaking to us from the Congress right now. Congressmember John Lewis is the senior Democratic chief deputy whip. He chairs the Ways and Means Subcommittee on Oversight. Well, we're going back in time, Congressman Lewis, but just 2 days ago, James Bonnard Fowler pled guilty to one count of second-degree manslaughter 2 weeks before he was to go on trial on two counts of murder in the 65 shooting of Jimmie Lee Jackson. You knew Jimmie Lee Jackson. You were at his funeral, Dr. Martin Luther King. Tell us about the significance of this plea this week.
Well, this is a significant breakthrough. There are so many of these cases, cold cases, that have been lingering for some time unsolved. And I was delighted and pleased to see the defendant come forward. I remember that period so well. I was very much involved in Marion, Perry County, and Selma, Alabama during those days. And when Jimmie Lee Jackson was shot and later died at a local hospital in Selma, Alabama, it was a very sad and dark hour for the civil rights movement. And we made a decision to march from Selma to Montgomery to dramatize the fact that this young man had been shot and later died because he was part of an effort to gain the right to vote for all of the citizens of Alabama.
Congressmember Lewis, describe the funeral for Jimmie Lee Jackson.
The funeral of Jimmie Lee Jackson was very sad. In this little community in the heart of the Black Belt of Alabama, Marion is the home of Coretta Scott King, the home of the late Mrs. Andrew Young. It was like the capital of the Black Belt. So hundreds and thousands of Black people from all over the Black Belt, but from all over Alabama and the South, came to the funeral. And that day was a gloomy day. It rained. And we walked from the church after Dr. King had delivered the eulogy to the cemetery, carrying his body to be buried. We knew then that his death and his funeral would become the linchpin, the spark to continue to fight for the right to vote. So Jimmie Lee Jackson's funeral was very sad, and his death, but he didn't die in vain. As it was said before, this young man was a veteran, a young leader in the movement there, participating in a nonviolent protest. And in America, whether it's in Selma, Alabama, or in Marion, Alabama, or in Washington, D.C., we have a right to protest in a peaceful, nonviolent fashion. And in my estimation, he was executed by this state trooper.
Do you feel satisfied with the sentence of 6 months and 6 months probation?
Well, I'm not satisfied. When you take the life of a person, you should serve more time, but hopeful this bring some closure that people at least know who did it. I don't buy the story that this state trooper said that he thought Jimmie Lee Jackson was going to grab his pistol and shoot him. I don't buy that. The people that participated in this march in Marion, as well as in Selma a few days later, was committed to the philosophy and the discipline of nonviolence.
Then talk about the Selma to Montgomery march, where you were so badly injured, your skull was fractured, that this happening right before that, the killing of Jimmie Lee Jackson, Congressmember Lewis.
Well, on March 7, 1965, we made a decision that we were going to march in an orderly, peaceful, nonviolent fashion from Selma to Montgomery. And along with one of Dr. King's staff members, a young man by the name of Jose Williams, I was asked to be one of the leaders of the march. We participated in a nonviolent workshop. Then 600 of us lined up in twos to walk all the way from Selma to Montgomery. We crossed the Alabama River, crossing the Edmund Pettus Bridge. And when we got to the highest point on the bridge, down below we saw a sea of blue, Alabama State Troopers. And we continued to walk. And we came within hearing distance of the State Troopers. And a man identified himself and said, "I'm Major John Cloud of the Alabama State Trooper. This is an unlawful march. You will not be allowed to continue. I give you 3 minutes to disperse and return to your church." And Jose Williams said to the Major, "Major, give us a moment to kneel and pray." And the Major said, "Troopers, advance." And you saw these men putting on their gas masks. And they came toward us, beating us with nightsticks, bull whips, shrimping us with horses, and releasing the tear gas. I was hit in the head by a state trooper with a nightstick, and I had a concussion at the bridge. I thought I was going to die. I thought I saw death. That Sunday became known as Bloody Sunday. A little more than 45 years later, I don't recall how I made it back across that bridge, through the streets of Selma, back to that little church that we had left from. But I do remember being at the church, and I stood up and said something like, "I don't understand it, how President Johnson can send troops to Vietnam and cannot send troops to Selma, Alabama, to protect people who only desire to register to vote." And that afternoon, 17 of us hurt and sent to the hospital where I stayed about 3 days.
Congressmember John Lewis describing the Selma to Montgomery march. Jimmie Lee Jackson is buried at the Heard Cemetery, an old slave burial ground next to his father. Since his burial, his headstone has been vandalized, bearing the marks of at least one shotgun blast. On his stone is written the words, "He was killed for man's freedom."
Well, Jimmie Lee Jackson, along with so many others, must be looked upon as the fathers and mothers of the new America. His death, with others, helped liberate not just a people, but a nation. And because of what he did and so many others did, President Johnson came to the Congress, made a dramatic speech, unbelievable address to the Congress, presented the Voting Rights Act. The Congress debated that proposal, passed it, and on August 6, 1965, President Johnson signed it into law. So I say, if it hadn't been for the struggle of individuals like Jimmie Lee Jackson, Viola Luzzo, and the three civil rights workers in Mississippi, and so many others, and what the Congress and what President Johnson did and said, President Barack Obama wouldn't be president of America today.
Just before President Obama became president, in January of 2008, he spotted you standing right nearby. The reports are he embraced you. This was an historic moment. You, who had spoken at the 1963 March on Washington, his address in Denver at the Democratic Convention was on the 45th anniversary of that historic march, with King giving his "I Have a Dream" speech and you giving a more radical address. And now, today, you are the senior Democratic chief deputy whip. You chair the Ways and Means Subcommittee on Oversight. But the House has shifted, and you will be in the minority. Your thoughts on what needs to happen and where the Republicans and the Democrats are going right now?
Well, as members of Congress, both Democrats and Republicans, we must come together in a bipartisan fashion to look out for the needs of all of the American people. We must get our economy moving again. We got to create jobs and put our people back to work. But we must come and work together. That was the message back in 1965, when we came together as a country and passed the 6-5 Voting Rights Act. That was the message in 1964 when we passed the Civil Rights Act, and 1968 when we passed the Fair Housing Act. And we can come together again and do good for the American people and look out for the common good.
The Republicans have refused to meet with President Obama now this week at the White House. Your thoughts on this?
Well, I'm shocked and dismayed that the Republicans couldn't find the time to meet with the President of the United States. It's a tradition. When the President calls, we tend to drop everything that we're doing and respond to that call and meet with the President.
Congressmember John Lewis, I want to thank you very much for being with us. We just finished a conversation about torture before this segment, about a Guantanamo prisoner on trial in New York, and ended with the question about Guantanamo not closing. And President Obama, though it was one of his first promises, ultimately it remains open. Your thoughts?
I think we must close it. It is a blight on the conscience and the soul of America. We need to do it, and we need to do it now.
What's stopping President Obama from fulfilling his promise?
Well, I think he need help and support for the Congress, but he could, in my estimation, issue an executive order and just make it happen. Just do it.
And the war in Afghanistan, your position on the surge and how the U.S. will get out of Afghanistan?
Well, I'm opposed to war. I think war is obsolete as a tool of our foreign policy. We need to bring all of our young men and our young women home and put an end to the violence abroad.
Do you think President Obama should not have escalated the war and should stop it now?
Well, I do not, and I did not, and I do not now support escalation of the war. We must stop it and end it now.
Congressmember John Lewis, thanks very much for being with us. Democrat from Georgia is speaking to us from the Capitol Rotunda. Senior Democratic Chief Deputy Whip chairs the Ways and Means Subcommittee on Oversight, though that will change. Final question, Congressmember Lewis, and that is your colleague, Congressmember Rangel, who has just been convicted on ethics charges by the Ethics Committee in the House. Your thoughts?
Well, it is very sad to see this happen to a friend and a colleague, my former chairman of the Ways and Means Committee. But the members of the committee have spoken, and it would be revealed, I guess, within the next few hours, the next few days, what would be the punishment.
Thanks for being with us, Congressmember Lewis. This is
Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. When we come back, former chief spokesperson for Cigna, now a whistleblower, talks about how the insurance industry targeted Michael Moore when he came out with his film Sicko. The strategy, push him off the cliff, said Wendell Potter. Stay with us.
We people darker than blue. Are we gonna stand around this town and let what others say come true? We're just good for nothing, they all figure. A boyish grown up shiftless jigger. Now we can't hardly stand for that. Or is that really where it's at?
We the people who are darker than blue, by Curtis Mayfield. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. We end today's show with part two of our conversation with the chief spokesperson for Cigna, before that for Humana, who spoke with us yesterday on Democracy Now! His name is Wendell Potter. In part two, he continues his conversation about the insurance industry's targeting of the Academy Award-winning filmmaker Michael Moore when he announced he'd be making a documentary about the American healthcare system, the film, of course, called Sicko. One of the key figures behind the campaign to discredit him was Wendell Potter. He talks about the policy on the part of all the insurance companies in dealing with Michael Moore.
We were very scared, and we knew that we would have to develop a very sophisticated and expensive campaign to turn people away from the idea of universal care. We were afraid that this might really galvanize public opinion. We were told by our pollsters in a meeting that was held just days after the premiere of the movie that, for the first time ever since they had been polling, that people were, a majority of people were in favor of much greater government involvement in our health care system.
Who were your pollsters?
McInturf, Public Opinion Strategies. Bill McInturf, who's a well-known Republican strategist and who went on to be John McCain's chief pollster. He's been a pollster for the insurance industry for probably two decades, and he had been tracking public opinion for all these years. And this really scared the insurers, the executives. We were all concerned about that because we felt that this movie would have such an impact that it would really pave the way for legislation to be passed that could be very detrimental to the insurance industry. So it's very important for the insurers to attack this movie as fiercely as possible.
And so what was the grassroots strategy, if you had one, as the movie came out in the United States?
One key component was to fund a front group, and that is something that I write about quite a bit in the book, about how special interests in the insurance industry in particular will use premium dollars to funnel thousands and thousands, if not millions of dollars, to big PR firms to set up fake grassroots organizations, AstroTurf, as we call it, and front groups. And in this case, there was a front group that was set up called Healthcare America, and the sole purpose for it to be set up was to attack Michael Moore and to attack the notion of a single-payer system in this country.
And who were the people who populated Healthcare America?
There were just a couple of people. There was a woman, I think her name was—I can't remember her name—Sarah Burke, I think, was her name. But the media contact for it was a guy named Bill Pierce, who I had known and worked with in the past. He used to be a PR guy for Blue Cross Blue Shield Association. At that time, he was in the public relations firm APCO Worldwide. He was listed as a media contact, and if you called his number, you would have reached him at his desk at APCO Worldwide. It didn't have any substance. It was just—
What is APCO Worldwide?
It is a very, very big PR firm that was started several years ago by a big Washington law firm, Arnold & Porter. The A&P is Arnold & Porter, and they were defending tobacco companies. So they felt that they needed to have help in the court of public opinion as well as in the courtroom.
And what did Healthcare America, who did they say they were?
They said they were representing consumers, and—
Did anyone expose this at the time?
No. No one did.
Did anyone have them on to counter what Michael Moore had to say on television, radio, or quote them in the newspaper?
No. In fact, and I've done a search recently just to find out how they were covered, and they were never exposed.
Were they quoted?
Oh, absolutely. They were quoted extensively. They sent out press releases, and they were given status as a legitimate organization, even by the New York Times.
In what article?
There was an article that the New York Times wrote as a kind of a review of Sicko. Not really a review, but just a story about the movie actually premiering in the U.S. in June of 2007. And the New York Times story quoted the Healthcare America spokesman as saying that this represented a move towards socialism. And there was apparently not an attempt on the part of the reporter or any reporter that I saw to disclose the fact that this was funded largely by the insurance industry.
Let's go to another clip of Sicko, of Michael Moore's film that they all so feared that they sent one lucky staff member, employee from Cigna, to the Riviera to watch the film festival where Michael Moore got a standing ovation for 15 minutes and then have a corporate conference call to report back on what they saw. This is Sicko.
This guy broke his ankle. How much will this cost him? He'll have some huge bill when he's done, right?
Here, NHS, everything is free.
I'm asking about hospital charges.
Yeah.
And you're laughing. Even with insurance, there's bound to be a bill somewhere. What'd they charge you for that baby?
No. Everything's on.
This is NHS.
Yeah, you know,
no,
it's not America.
So this is where people come to pay their bill when they're done staying in the hospital.
No, this is the NHS hospital, so you don't pay the bill.
Why does it say cashier here if people don't have to pay a bill?
Those who have reduced means get their travel expenses reimbursed.
So in British hospitals, instead of money going into the cashier's window, money comes out.
Yeah, they look at me like I'm from Mars when I'm asking the Brits, you know, how much they you know, paid for, you know, this, that, or whatever.
We're talking to Michael Moore. Let's talk about how we arrived at the system we did in this country.
Well, you know, my grandfather was a country doctor, actually. He was from Canada. He went to medical school in the late 1800s, which was a year then. You know, it's about what, pretty much what they knew back then. They could teach it in a year. And so the little village where, you know, I was raised, because my mom was from there, too, because he was there. And, you know, he was paid with eggs and milk and chickens and things like that. He didn't do it to make any big money. They didn't make big money then. They were comfortable, the local doctor, but they weren't the rich man in the community. We got away from the concept of treating people because it was the right thing to do. The nuns ran the hospital that I was born in. The nuns weren't doing this to turn profit and invest in Wall Street. You know, I mean, they did it because they thought that was their duty to serve God and serve mankind by opening hospitals and delivering babies. We're a long ways from that now. Somewhere we let profit and greed enter into this. And in the film, I peg a certain date when the HMOs really got their start. And I got very lucky. I had a 23-year-old researcher in my office who worked on the film, who was actually someone I believe that was recommended by Jeremy Scahill. So there's a Democracy Now! Connection to this moment in the movie. But he found this Watergate tape. It has nothing to do with Watergate. It's one of the Nixon tapes at the archives, National Archives, where Nixon and Ehrlichman are discussing whether or not to support this HMO concept. And Ehrlichman says to Nixon, you're going to love this because this is private enterprise. This isn't like some freebie thing. And Nixon goes, oh, I like that. Well, tell me about it. And then Ehrlichman says, well, this is how it's going to work, these HMOs. They're going to make more money by providing less care. The less care they give them, the patients, the more money the company makes. And Nixon goes, ooh, not bad. And it's all there on tape.
Wendell, you are laughing as Michael's describing the Ehrlichman tape, the Nixon, Ehrlichman, Haldeman. You know this tape.
I do know that tape, and it was, I think, a great find.
Did anyone ever tell you you look a little like John Haldeman?
Thank you. Maybe. I don't know. But, and it was important for that conversation. The important was really that conversation was very important because at that time, Ted Kennedy was trying to get legislation enacted that would have been a Medicare for all system, in which we would have had a single payer system in this country. So Nixon was desperate to find some private enterprise solution that could be used as a counter to what Ted Kennedy was trying to do at that time. It's very important.
I want to go back to Healthcare America. This is really important, what you've just been describing, this AstroTurf organization that's quoted by the New York Times and other publications and media as a consumer healthcare group that isn't, that's sitting in APCO, made by Arnold and Porter, who represented the tobacco companies. And they're there to kill any idea of public option or anything like that. What other organizations are there? And how successful did you think you were in dealing with sicko? Did you think you contained the message?
There's no doubt we felt we were successful in blunting the impact of the movie. We were concerned that the movie would be as successful as Fahrenheit 9/11 had been. And we knew that if it were, it really would change public opinion about our health care system in ways that would be harmful to the profits of health insurers. So it was very important for this campaign to succeed. At one point during a strategy meeting, one of the people from APCO said that if our efforts, our initial efforts were not successful, then we'd have to move to an element of the campaign to push Michael Moore off a cliff. And not meaning to do that literally.
Are you sure?
Well, I'm not sure. To tell you the truth, when I started doing what I'm doing, I was concerned about my own health and well-being, maybe just from paranoia. But these companies play to win. And
Wendell Potter was the chief spokesperson for the insurance giant Cigna when Michael Moore's film Sicko came out. Now Wendell Potter is a chief whistleblower. His book is called Deadly Spin. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Berkshire, for the producer, Armata Angiocama, Steve Martinez, Nicole Salazar, I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.